Good morning, Connecticut. To our friends across the sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokat. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, spring is officially upon us, but unfortunately, due to the wacky weather we're experiencing, that pounding headache, sore throat, or sniffles could mean your allergies are acting up. Or maybe you're suffering from an onset of a sinus infection. Today, we're going to open with an expert who might help you determine the difference between allergies, a cold, and a sinus infection, and shed some light on symptoms and treatments for sinus and respiratory issues. Then we'll continue with our new series, Organicon Bites, featuring exhibitors and speakers who are part of the 2019 Northeast Organic Farming Association's Organicon Winter Conference, held recently at Housatonic College in Bridgeport. Today, we'll learn about the Regeneration Northeast Alliance, and we'll speak with a veterinarian about how you can help make your pet's diet and lifestyle healthier. Then we're going to close with a replay of a segment from January that's focusing on a subject that was back in the news this week. We're going to chat with a field organizer from the Connecticut chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union and learn more about the launch of their Smart Justice Initiative that's being deliberated right now before the state legislature. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokat, right after this reminder. On Saturday, May 4th, from 8 to 3, the American Association of University Women's Connecticut Chapter will host its 6th annual Tech Savvy Conference at Trinity College in Hartford. The conference is open to 6th to 9th grade girls who want to learn about careers in science, technology, math, and engineering, and for parents and educators who want to encourage girls to realize their potential in these fields. Throughout the day, girls can attend 4 of 9 hands-on workshops and enjoy brief tours of the Trinity campus, while workshops and panel discussions are providing parents, guardians, and teachers the tools to encourage girls' exploration of STEM careers. Admission is just $5. To learn more and sign up for the event, visit the American Association of University Women's Connecticut Chapter website. That's at aauct.aauw.net. Well, have you been sniffling, sneezing, or had that pesky headache? Spring is in the air, but so are pollen and allergens from new blooms and buds that are going to be causing sniffles, sneezes, sore throats, and coughs for some time into the future. But how do you know the difference between allergies or a cold and a sinus infection? We've got someone who's going to help us understand the difference, Brendan Battery, who is a physician's assistant at AFC Urgent Care, is here with us. AFC Urgent Care has offices near you in West Hartford, Danbury, Vernon, New Britain, and a new center in Torrington. And Brandon is here today to kind of help us clear the air and better understand the symptoms and treatments for sinus and respiratory issues, whether they're just from allergies or something worse. So, Brandon, thanks for joining us. We chatted a few moments before we went on the air this morning. Brandon is a lifer here in Connecticut, talking to us or coming to us from Vernon. Let's start, Brandon, by talking about what nasal allergies actually are and what causes them.
Absolutely. So nasal allergens are going to be things that your body is exposed to, things like pollen, mold, animal dander, dust, trees, things like that. They're going to aggravate your body and create the allergy symptoms that you experience.
Mm-hmm. So these are airborne micro particles that you breathe in and they get up into the front of your head?
Correct. So as far as the seasonal nasal allergies, that's correct.
And basically, with this wacky weather that we've been having, some people said that they started to see trees and plants budding all the way back just after Christmas time and in the early part of January. Then it got cold again. Then it got really warm again, and some more buds started coming out. Are you already starting to see springtime allergies affecting your patients?
Yeah, so we're just getting going with the allergy season. It's just starting to come in. Really starts getting going, you know, end of March, April, and then, you know, April, May, those are those big months for allergy symptoms.
and then it sort of drops off in the heat of summer, and then there's a autumn allergy season as well?
Correct, correct. So that dry weather, that hot weather really kind of calms it down, and then as the seasons change and as the leaves fall off, definitely there's an, another fall allergy peak as well.
Okay. So are the majority of people who have allergic reactions, is that because there's this huge predisposition to react to things like pollen?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a lot of people are sensitive to pollen. In fact, most of us are sensitive to pollen. It's just a matter of how sensitive. So some people are way more sensitive than others, and that's what kind of determines how severe your symptoms are.
So are there particular producers of pollen that are worse or that, you know, because of either the population of these trees and bushes or the potency of the pollen? How does that work?
Yeah, so really trees and grass are the big ones. So in the Northeast, you got elm, hickory, oak trees, and then pollen from grass. Really, you know, beginning in April, those are the big ones for there.
Mm-hmm. Does that exacerbate people like me who have year-round allergies to things like pet dander and dust?
It can. Now, it's always kind of a unique case-by-case person. Now, a lot of times, if you have a significant allergy history, you can actually get, like, skin prick testing from an allergist. And that can give you kind of an exact ratio of how severely allergic you are to certain products like pollen and trees and dander and dust and things like that to further figure out exactly what you're allergic to.
Is that part of a normal regimen of testing that people would get if they come in to see you with the generic complaint of allergy-like symptoms so that you could rule out that it's not something else?
So it's possible that we can do allergy testing. A lot of times we are going to treat with, you know, certain medications to start with if they have a lot of allergy symptoms. And if it gets to a point where it's very severe and we're not really sure what the cause is, a lot of people are very smart. They understand what the cause is. They go outside and they ride their bike in the spring and they go, oh, you know, I'm starting to feel the symptoms. And then they know it's going to be pollen or trees or something like that. Or it's going to be someone who's, you know, wintertime inside a lot and they're cleaning the house and they're getting the dust and then they start feeling the symptoms. And so a lot of times we do not initially start with allergy testing, but if we're having a hard time figuring out what the cause is or if we're having a hard time treating it, then we'll either send them to an allergist for testing or get the testing done here ourselves.
So, well, are there any ways that people can, I mean, aside from, I mean, I would imagine it's even for folks that are only impacted by seasonal allergies, it's almost impossible to get away from them because they're microscopic and they permeate the air and get everywhere. Is there anything that people can do to maybe more minimize the impact of these seasonal affectations?
Yeah, absolutely. So as far as avoiding or limiting the exposure, number one, and so, you know, obviously if you're outside, you know, being smart with it. So, you know, if you're touching the grass or having, you know, rolling around and things like that, you know, go wash your hands when you come inside, wash your clothes. You know, if you're someone who is really allergic, maybe don't sleep with the windows open, wearing sunglasses outside so you're not rubbing your eyes. And then also you can even check daily pollen counts on like weatherchannel.com and like things like that, where you can see how bad is the allergy in the air at that day. And maybe on days that are really, really severe, you know, change your outdoor plans if you're very allergic to those things.
Oh, okay. And you mentioned fluids?
I didn't, but absolutely, that's always crucial. You know, staying hydrated is always going to help with any bodily system.
So I know that there's, you know, also, you know, hydrating your eyes, I guess, with fluids would help both flush out any kind of particulate matter that's gotten in there that might be an allergen. But if I understand correctly, certain kinds of eye drops are actually counterproductive because they're really meant to kind of shrink the blood vessels in your eyes, and they actually act more as like a drying action than a lubricating action. Are there specific kinds of eye drops that help people, or are they just kind of marked on the counter as being specific for relief of allergy symptoms?
Yeah. So over the counter, there definitely will be marked for allergy symptoms or for, you know, the itchy eyes, the red eyes, things like that. Any sort of kind of saline drop or soothing drop, Visine drop, you know, like a Nafcane, which has a mild antihistamine in it, that'll help with those symptoms with the eyes for sure.
Okay. So how does a person actually tell the difference between whether they're having like cold or sinus infection symptoms or it's just allergies?
So a lot of times the symptoms can kind of all blend together and be a little bit difficult to discern. A lot of times, a couple things. One, with a cold or kind of an upper respiratory illness or infection, you may feel extra fatigue, you may feel achy, and just feel kind of crummy. And you may have a fever, plus or minus a fever. That can be more indicative of a viral infection or something more like a sinus infection. Whereas the allergies, you're just going to have those symptoms, you know, things like runny nose, nasal congestion, itchy eyes, watery eyes. Those are kind of the main symptoms of allergies, where you're not going to get that, you know, typically the malaise, the feeling crummy or bad, or the muscle aches, or the fevers as well.
Mm. Does can having intense allergy reactions cause a cold or a nasal infection?
So not necessarily cause a cold, but can it predispose you to a cold because your body is more sensitive? Absolutely. But directly causing it, I would say no.
And infections as well, like if you have that,
correct,
you know, long intense periods of like runny nose, that is not a precursor to like a sinus infection?
No, not necessarily.
Okay. So how would people make a decision as to whether or not they need to actually seek out medical attention versus self-treating with over-the-counter or whatever mom told you to do?
The biggest thing, fever is number one. So any sort of significant fever over 100.4 degrees consistently could be signs of flu or a sinus infection or something more severe than just your average cold or average allergies. If you're having intense pain in the face and a lot of tenderness around your head and sinuses and maybe even in the back of the ears or your forehead, then we could be dealing with potentially even a sinus infection. And those are kind of the big ones as far as when we're dealing with allergies and cold, what are some kind of red flags to look for?
Hmm. Speaking for myself, as well as a number of other people that I've talked to over the years, we experience something that is not unlike a migraine, especially at times when there are severe and rapid, like high to low pressure changes, when it goes from like being really wet and rainy to suddenly, you know, by the next morning, it's like high, low humidity, really, really dry. It's you get the low grade fever, nausea, that kind of frontal pain around the eyes and the throbbing that seems to dissipate, you know, after maybe some, you have a cup of coffee or something to eat, or maybe take some kind of over-the-counter sinus pressure relief. But it's chronic and it's not migraine. Is that something that you see?
Absolutely. That can definitely be something we see. And that's more along the lines like a chronic sinusitis, which actually can be more allergen or environmentally induced versus like a viral or bacterial infection.
Hmm. Very good. And how are those treated?
So those can be treated in a variety of ways. If you're really dealing with true chronic sinusitis and we're failing treatments left and right, you know, we're doing the antihistamines, you're doing nasal sprays, oral steroids, things like that, you know, trial antibiotics if it's really gunky stuff and feverish and looks like a sinus infection and nothing's working, I would send you to ENT, who they can actually, you know, take a look up inside the sinuses, see if there's a polyp that's a problem, see if there is something going on in there that's causing the chronic symptoms, to try and get you better relief.
Great. What can folks do or what do you advise folks to do in the event that you discover they just need some treatment for allergy?
So first things first is antihistamine medicine. That's kind of one of the first starters. You know, they're all over the counter at this point. You know, Claritin, Zyrtec, Allegra, Zizol, those are all the main ones. Those are the non-sedating one versus Benadryl, which is a sedating one. So I always tell people, be careful which one you're picking. You definitely don't want to take Benadryl in the middle of the day if you have a lot of things to do. That's kind of number one. If that's failing, you can add on or in place of try like a nasal steroid spray. That's going to be like your Flonase or Nasacort, things like that, which can be very effective for the nasal symptoms. Be careful, though, because there is something out there called Afrin, which is a nasal decongestant, also known as oxymetazoline. That is slightly different than the nasal steroids. That is something that you can use to help with congestion, but it's not something that should be used on a daily basis chronically. It can cause pretty much a really bad sinus infection is what you're dealing with, really bad sinusitis. We get a ton of inflammation in the head and pressure, and the only thing that helps is taking the Afrin again. So that one can be a little bit tricky and a little bit, you know, I would definitely stay away from using that daily. Mm-hmm. But you can use that as needed to help with congestion as well.
Great. How about natural remedies?
So natural remedies, things like just a simple nasal saline rinses, neti pots, things like that can really help out, kind of clear out the sinuses. And I have a lot of chronic sinus sufferers that you know, swear by the neti pot and really do, you know, think that it works very well for flushing those allergens out of the sinus cavity and in the nasal cavity.
And I know that when I was undergoing some treatments for throat cancer, my doctor was telling me that there's some really, really interesting restorative powers in natural honey. Where do you come down on using honey as some sort of an addition to that natural treatment?
So in my opinion, it can't hurt. So, you know, why not try it? You know, there's not a lot of risk to trying local honey. And things like that. But, you know, as far as a true, you know, study, clinical studies with science, there's really no, you know, clinical efficacy shown with treating seasonal allergies per se. But it has shown to help with things like cough and things like that. But seasonal allergies per se, there's been no, you know, absolutely 100% proven clinical trial after clinical trial showing that it's fantastic.
Okay. How about permanent solutions? Are there treatments available mm-hmm. for folks to get rid of these symptoms on an ongoing basis?
Mm-hmm. So especially this is more geared towards the severe allergy sufferers, people who have kind of mild symptoms who take the antihistamine with relief. We wouldn't recommend things like this, but if you're having severe symptoms and you're failing all the over-the-counter treatments, you're failing other prescription medicines, things like allergy shots or immunotherapy injections, are one of the most effective things for treating allergies, and that is done through a specialist or an allergist, and that would be one of the main things to just calm down that sensitivity reactions to all the allergens you could be exposed to.
Very good. Now, I understand AFC Urgent Care has a video series.
Yeah, so it's called AFC Urgent Care Medical Minute. It's on our YouTube channel, so you can just YouTube that whole statement, the AFC Urgent Care Medical Minute, to just learn about more and more kind of things like the flu or seasonal health issues.
Great. Well, if folks have heard something today that is beneficial to them and they want to find out more, of course, they can visit Brendan and one of his colleagues at AFC Urgent Care to learn more about that organization or to find a location near you somewhere here in Connecticut. You can go to afcurgentcare.com. And we want to thank our guest this morning, Brendan Battery. He's a physician's assistant at AFC Urgent Care for helping us understand and giving us some tips on how to navigate the situation if we're feeling under the weather and making a decision as to whether or not we might be suffering from just seasonal allergies or something worse like a cold, the flu, or some sort of a sinus infection. Brendan, it was great to talk to you. Learned a lot today, and thanks for being on the program. As we move through the exhibit floor here at Organicon 2019, we have run into Adam Sachs. He's executive director of Regeneration Northeast, which has some complex ties to a biodiversity for a livable climate, a project of the Biodiversity for a Livable Climate organization. bio4climate.org is their website if you'd like to start researching them. But let's do some research of our own right here on radio. Adam, tell us a little bit more about Regeneration Northeast and how it fits under the Biodiversity for a Livable Climate umbrella.
Regeneration Northeast is a new ally of an organization called Regeneration International, and we advocate for regenerative land management of all kinds, particularly farming, but not exclusively. Regenerative land management is an approach to land that improves its health, improves its fertility, improves its biodiversity as we use it for human purposes as well. So as opposed to farming, which uses a lot of toxic inputs and synthetic pesticides and fertilizers, regenerative management uses only natural approaches that improve the land, improve the soils, pull carbon into the soils, allow much more water to go into the soils, and ultimately create more biodiversity and better food and all kinds of things, and cool the biosphere so that it has a positive effect on climate.
Is this something that is also applicable to even individuals that have large or even small gardens on their own personal properties, or is this more large scale for farmers?
This is any scale. So if you're just doing a small garden, you can do it regeneratively. There are some basic rules. You use cover crops. You don't do any kind of tilling. You drill the seeds into the soil, or you can poke the hole with your finger and put the seeds in them if you're doing it on a small scale. You always keep soil covered. Nature doesn't leave soil uncovered. When soil is uncovered and exposed to sun and air, it starts to die. And so one of the basic principles, as I've said, is always have something covering the soil. It can be mulch, it can be a cover crop, but you want to keep the soil cool. So it could be 95 degrees outside and hot, and under the mulch and under the cover crop, it could be 60 degrees. And that's a very important factor. And it's partly because when you keep soil covered, it holds water in, which is an essential part of the process of regenerative land management.
I guess anybody that's ever kicked a little patch of leaves on their lawn and found that that wet under area can identify with that concept.
Absolutely. And we know from experience that you can have a 50, 60 degree Fahrenheit difference in the same spot on exposed soil compared to covered and moist soil. Because as soon as soil is exposed, the water evaporates and all kinds of destructive things start to happen.
So what's your background, Adam? Are you a farmer, a scientist, or just somebody who's learned how to take better care of the environment?
I've been a climate activist for 20 years and learning a lot about the many factors in climate, including how soils and water are such an important part. So I started the usual climate activist route, advocating for lower emissions and alternative energy, which of course I still support. But after about 8 years of that, this is probably around 2008, I felt that things were not changing fast enough, that there was a missing piece. So I started to learn more about agriculture and soil biology, and this led to the founding of Biodiversity for a Livable Climate with three colleagues. And what we do is we do a lot of education. We're kind of a think tank. So we've had 12 conferences in the past 4 years, and our 200-plus videos from the conference talks are online and have been viewed on YouTube about 130,000 times by now. And the speakers we've had have come from all over the world to talk about how they've managed their farms, their gardens, their habitats in a way that restores them. And so Africa, South America, Australia, I mean, just anywhere there is a habitable landscape, we can turn it around from being, I mean, we have stories of deserts that
are productive.
They turn into, well, many current deserts used to be grasslands, and they were poorly treated and overgrazed, And when you reverse that and graze them properly the way nature does, which is grazing animals in tight herds for protection from predators, and then they fertilize and stir up the soil and move on. And then the soil life has a field day. And what happens when ranchers do this over a period of time is they find that they have more grass than they can manage. They have to keep adding animals because grazing animals and grasslands co-evolved over around 25 million years. They need each other.
Oh, okay.
So the grasses, if they're not bitten down, they're designed to be bitten down. They're not bitten down by the animals. They shade out the new growth, next year's growth, and it starts to die. So they need the animals there. And the animals, especially in arid areas, are a reservoir of water. And microbes, that the soil microbes that are needed for the grasslands to be abundant. So all kinds of things happen when you start to turn that around.
Yeah.
The biodiversity increases dramatically. You get creatures, birds, and snakes, and all kinds of things that haven't been seen in decades.
Mm.
They come back.
Wow.
And the biodiversity of the plants as well.
So in closing, Adam, I know I have farmers who listen to the program, but mostly the folks that are going to be listening are homeowners and property owners that are thinking about maybe making the change to all organic or even maybe starting a home yard garden for the first time. Is there different advice that you would have for somebody who has a long established neighborhood garden or yard garden versus somebody who wants to start one for the first time? Is it a completely different process under the practice that you're promoting with Regeneration Northeast?
There's a transition period. If you've been gardening or farming in the conventional manner, and so I would recommend that you do some reading about it from people who have made the transition. There is a great 12-minute video out there called Soil Carbon Cowboys, and it's about three ranchers who have had to go through the transition. Gabe Brown is one of them, and he has been getting considerable renown in the past few years. So you might read his book called Dirt to Soil, which just came out last year. Judy Schwartz has a book called called Cows Save the Planet, and also Water in Plain Sight. Those are also good books to start with. But check in with your local NRCS or local NOFAs, and there'll be plenty of people who can help you make that transition.
Very good. Well, we'll let you clear some of that dry soil out of your throat there, Adam. But thank you so much.
Thank
Adam
you.
Sachs is with Regeneration Northeast, an alliance and a project of biodiversity for a livable climate. If you'd like to start there, looking at their website, it's bio4climate.org. And is there a separate website for Regeneration Northeast?
RegenerationNortheast.org.
Very good. Thank you.
Two ends in the middle. Regeneration Northeast.
Gotcha. Adam Sachs, thank you so much. Here from Organicon 2019 at Housatonic Community College in Bridgeport.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. And while you're checking out the website, if you work for or are involved with a local or regional charity or nonprofit, you can apply for the 2019 Love CT Media Grant that'll provide a qualifying nonprofit with $5,000 in on-air promotional advertising to use across the entire network of Connecticut Connoisseur radio stations to promote volunteerism, events, fundraisers, or just your brand awareness. Make it quick, because the deadline to apply is April 12th. Apply for Love CT Advertising Grants now. I'm Director of Public Affairs John Vocat. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. A grandmother reaching for prescription pills from her medicine cabinet is not the image that most people would associate with a drug addiction. Although the National Institute on Drug Abuse reports that young adults misuse prescriptions and illicit drugs more frequently than older generations, painkiller abuse has soared among those over age 65. In fact, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services found that 40 million Americans who enrolled in Medicare Part D in 2016, one-third were prescribed opioids, and many were prescribed more than the recommended dosage. If you know or love a senior in the grips of an opioid addiction, consider Mountainside, a national recognized facility for drug and alcohol addiction treatment programs close to home here in Connecticut. You can learn more about Mountainside by visiting their website, mountainside.com.
All right. Well, we ducked out of the noise of the trade show floor here at the Organicon 2019 for the Northeast Organic Farming Association to visit with Dr. Stephen Tobin, who did a talk today at the conference on holistic pet care. His practice is in Meriden, and we sat in on most of his session and heard a few interesting things. So without further ado, Dr. Tobin, let's first talk a little bit about the raw food diet, and you had a handout that that helps people kind of get started converting to food that dogs and cats have been eating, as you pointed out, for somewhere between 5 and 10 million years.
Well, dogs and cats are carnivores, and they should be fed a diet that's appropriate for a carnivore, which for just about all carnivores, except maybe snakes, could be made up of the whole animal. Snakes also eat the whole animal, but in one bite. Mm. Whereas if you prepare this, you can cut it up into small pieces. But basically, it consists of everything that they would get by eating the whole animal. More than just meat. You want meat, bone, the fat, but also the organs, the head, and some of the indigestible parts like feathers and fur.
The roughage.
Yeah, they need some bulk too. Yeah. Otherwise, things don't pass through.
And you also talked about how giving them uncooked or even in some cases small cooked bones, great for the teeth.
Yeah, if they gnaw through bones, you'll see that they scrape their teeth. I mean, dogs certainly should be getting bones. They should regularly have them in front of them. Now, what the advantages are of the bones, one, it scrapes the teeth clean, but it also exercises the jaw, helps develop good jaw muscles. And they need the calcium from it as well.
Mm-hmm. I heard you mention something about if you're going to be feeding the animal's bones, you want to look for the red marrow?
Yeah. If you take the femur, which if you go to the supermarket, you'll find a package that's labeled marrow bones. And what this is generally the femur. It's cut up into sections. Now, they cut it into cross sections. So the first thing you'd probably see in the middle are these round bits that have dense bone on the outside and white marrow in the inside. And the white marrow is just fat. The outside is a very dense bone. If the dogs gnaw on that or try to bite on that, then there's a reasonable possibility that they'll break their teeth. Uh-huh. And they have. You know, not every dog that chews on every bone is going to break its teeth. But there is that risk. The red marrow is more towards the end of those bones. When you cut it, you can see, one, it looks more red in the bone. And what this is thin plates of bone interspersed with marrow, both white marrow and red marrow there. Mm-hmm. So when the dog gnaws on it, they're scraping some of the bone away, releasing more of the marrow there so it has more flavor. Because the center part, once they've licked out the white marrow, the fat, then there's nothing left that has any flavor. Whereas with the red marrow, you have bone interspersed with marrow. So this is actually better when they're scraping at it, because this at the same time is scraping at their teeth.
Mm-hmm. So earlier when you talked about the best and most advantageous diet for dogs and cats would be parts of the whole animal, in lieu of that, for folks who don't want to be that involved in having to get and process and store. Oops, that's his phone, folks. Perfect for a veterinarian. If you just tuned in, we're talking with Dr. Stephen Tobin, who's presenting here at the NOFA Organicon 2019 conference, and going to pick up the conversation with the best alternative for folks who do want to get their pets started on raw food, but don't have the wherewithal or the stomach to be getting and processing the whole animal. It could be as simple as we sort of talked about before we went on mic, you know, going out and getting whole chicken quarters and cutting them up and feeding them that.
Well, the chicken quarters definitely are the cheapest meat you're going to get. But, I mean, if you don't want to do the cooking, you want something really simple, just use some ground beef. Add some fish oil to it, some yogurt, and a few times a week some organ meat, maybe liver, and the bones to gnaw on. You have a complete diet there. Oh, and some fiber, some bran works fine, psyllium husks.
Oh, okay. All raw.
Well, it could be raw, or you can cook it.
Oh, okay. And the one thing we'll leave the subject on is long bones. You mentioned that folks have to watch out for giving them, like, a whole chicken leg or a whole thigh.
Well, for dogs, they can break those chicken bones. And then you have long, sharp pieces, splinters, that can cause a problem. The reason that I recommend cooking the chicken is so you can get those long bones out. The other bones, the pelvis, backbone, neck bone, rib cage, those the dogs will chew up without any problem. But the long bones, the two leg bone, thigh bone, first wing bone, those really should be removed because they have the potential of causing problems.
Very good. Let's switch subjects to vaccines, because you had a really interesting comment, and I'm not sure I've ever heard before about, in a lot of cases, just getting the very first vaccine for a very young animal, and then I guess the antibodies are present that need to be injected into the dog if it's going to stick, basically, right? And then it stays with them for their entire lives.
But you don't want to vaccinate a very young animal because they still have maternal antibodies, which would interfere with producing their own antibodies.
Mm-hmm.
But after 10 weeks of age, these are pretty much gone. Okay. So if you give a vaccination to a dog or cat 10 weeks or older, then they will react to it. They'll produce antibodies, but they also produce memory cells, which have the potential, when they're stimulated in the future, of multiplying like mad, throwing out lots of antibodies so that the animal's protected. So really, one vaccination anytime after 10 weeks of age would be protective with an effective vaccine. Now, some vaccines are not really effective vaccines. The core, what they call the core vaccines, are effective. So that's the distemper vaccine for dogs, and also different distemper vaccine for cats.
Mm-hmm. And there is the caveat of the rabies vaccine, which in a lot of communities in Connecticut are required to be up to date for licensing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the rabies vaccine, I use a 3-year licensed vaccine. Now, the first, in Connecticut, all dogs and cats 3 months and older have to be they have to be vaccinated for rabies. I use a 3-year vaccine, licensed vaccine, But the first shot, no matter what vaccine you use, is only good for 1 year. When you booster it with a three-year licensed vaccine, then that would be good for 3 years.
Very good. And finally, you did have a few interesting pointers about flea and tick protection, including a very simple to mix non-toxic formula that can be sprayed on the dogs or cats, for that matter, that will protect them and will reduce or eliminate the need for any sort of a pharmaceutical or chemical applications.
Well, okay, let me correct you there.
Oh, okay.
Because now what I make up is a spray that consists of half an ounce of cedarwood oil in a pint of rubbing alcohol. For dogs, this works quite well, as long as you're taking them on a walk or just letting them out in a tick-infested area. You give one spritz under the neck and one on the back of the neck, and that's good for at least 4 hours. Now, if you have a cat that's outside continually, then you're not, the protection is going to wear off after a while, and then they'll pick up ticks or fleas.
So in those cases, some other product that keeps some sort of a anti or a repellent component is necessary?
Well, if the cat is going to be outside all the time, probably it would be a good idea to use something that would work as a spot-on. You know, because that way, the only way you're going to kill the ticks is when the tick drinks some blood from the animal. It's getting some of this poison. Now, it would be difficult every day to give a dose of this. So you use one of these once-a-month spot-ons, and it'll work. I don't think it's ideal, but I can't think of anything better.
Okay. Very good. Well, and fleas? A tip about fleas?
Okay. Fleas live on the animal. They don't hop from one animal to another. And their life cycle is they're on the animal. They get their meals there. They lay their eggs there. The eggs fall off, and then they develop in the environment. So the flea larvae may be crawling in the basement or in the carpets. They go through all the stages. They pupate. When they come out of the cocoon, out of the pupa, then they're looking for another host. And they're going to hop on either a dog or a cat that comes by, or if you're walking by in shorts, they may hop on your legs. Now, they're not going to stay where it's too cold, so they're not going to stay on your legs. But they like the body temperature of the dog or cat. Now, where cats are likely to pick this up is under, well, in protected areas, under porches, decks, where it may be moist, but it's not wet. Dogs, and really the best way to avoid fleas in dogs is not take the dog visiting strange houses where you don't know if they have fleas there. Don't let other dogs into your house if you don't know that they don't have fleas. And certainly don't let cats go in and out. Really, the way dogs generally get the fleas is if there's a cat in the household, cat is an indoor-outdoor cat, and gets fleas, brings it in, drops eggs, they develop, and then the dog picks it up. But also keep the dog from going under decks and porches when you're on a walk, and you'll greatly reduce the likelihood of picking up fleas.
Fantastic. A great little mini-seminar for pet owners. Thanks to you, Dr. Stephen Tobin. His holistic pet care practice is in Meriden. He's been at this a little over three decades, so a wealth of information from you this morning. Thank you, Dr. Tobin.
Thank you.
We talk quite a lot about putting folks back into society successfully and helping them engage with the workforce from incarceration. And today is no different. The ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union of Connecticut's Smart Justice Initiative, is led by formerly incarcerated people, and it's a campaign dedicated to ending mass incarceration and eliminating racial disparities in the justice system. As we speak with our guest this morning, Gus Marks Hamilton will be broadcasting this a few days after a press conference, but it's kind of a weird dynamic because we're taping the program just about an hour before he goes into the press conference. So we're sort of in this weird time warp here where we're going to be talking about something that's happening in the future as we tape it, but a few days in the past as people hear about it. So Gus, welcome to the program. Gus Marks Hamilton is with the Smart Justice or initiative. He's a field organizer. So Gus, let's tell me a little bit about yourself real quick and how you got engaged with this. It's only been a few months, but you kind of hit the ground running with the ACLU of Connecticut, jumping right in up in the campaigns and initiatives leading up to the governor, Governor Ned Lamont, taking office last week.
Well, thank you initially, John, for having me on your program. I've been interested in criminal justice issues for a number of years. Firstly, as somebody who was formerly incarcerated, since I got out, I was able to attend a graduate program and graduated with a master's degree in social work. And I'm interested in, you know, bringing reform to the criminal justice system, not here in Connecticut, but across the country. And that's been, I think, reflected in a lot of the reforms that have been going on, the awareness that incarcerating people is not good for society, it's not good for the people that are incarcerated. The vast majority of people who are in prison will be coming out at some point, and they'll be rejoining their communities. And it's in the best interest of everyone in the state of Connecticut, everyone across the country, to make sure that people who have been formerly incarcerated become productive, successful, and responsible citizens.
It is somewhat of a niche interest, but no matter where you're from, Gus, I have to imagine that people in Connecticut, for the most part, don't realize how everyone else, even outside the United States, looks at Connecticut for having set the bar in so many ways in terms of the way folks coming out of incarceration can successfully reenter their lives?
Well, part of the work we're working on right now is that reintegration part. Mm-hmm. Connecticut has made significant decreases in its prison population. You know, about 8 years ago, Connecticut's prison population was over 20,000 people. I mean, compared to the overall population of the state, it was one of the largest in the country. But since then, since about 2010, 2011, today, the prison population is about 13,500 people. So that's almost a third in the reduction of the prison population that's been able to happen. And that has been simultaneously seen as the crime rate in the state is at the lowest it's been since the early to mid-1970s. Uh-huh. So I think people generally realize that, you know, simply releasing people is not necessarily going to lead to any public safety issues. But at the same time, now we need to work on the people who have been incarcerated. There are over 40,000 people in the state of Connecticut who are on parole or on probation. And these people need to be able to become successful, productive citizens in order to make our state stronger and safer.
In your capacity and in your interaction with lawmakers and perhaps even Governor-elect Ned Lamont prior to his taking office last week, did you get the feeling that he may not only pick up the baton from where our former Governor Malloy left off in terms of these improvements and the Smart Justice Initiative, or perhaps even Governor Lamont has some ideas that he shared with the ACLU or even you yourself about other directions he wants to go in or even ways to improve what we have now?
Governor Malloy, in the 8 years that he was governor, made a lot of changes in the way criminal justice is looked at. A lot of people in the administration did a lot of work on criminal justice reform. But when we interacted with you know, then candidate Ned Lamont over the summer and the fall, what we realized was even though he was open to talking about criminal justice, he had no he didn't know very much about the system at the beginning. He didn't really have any ideas in terms of how to carry forward some of the reform work that the previous administration had done. So when we met with him beginning in August, we met with him. We met with some of his policy people. When he won the election in November, he set up his transition teams, and one of them was a transition team exclusively centered on criminal justice policy. So we feel like the Governor Lamont has come a long way in terms of not having a criminal justice policy platform at all to finally publishing one and then making it an important part of his administration going forward. I think he realizes that what's good for people that have been formerly incarcerated, people that have been justice impacted, is not just better for them in terms of helping them turn their lives around and become, you know, good citizens for the state of Connecticut. It's good for the entire state.
Yes, because you not only don't want that that cost drain of the incarcerated individual,
absolutely,
which who is not contributing at all, but is a real burden on Connecticut taxpayers. You want that to flip all the way in the other direction, and you want them to not only be happy contributing members of their community, but contributing taxpayers here in Connecticut and contributors to our workforce.
Yeah, I think there's no debate about the cost of incarcerating somebody. You know, the estimates kind of vary all over the place, but it's about $53,000 a year to incarcerate one person in the state of Connecticut. The Department of Corrections budget has ballooned over the last 20 to 30 years as mass incarceration has grown. It makes a lot more sense to, rather than incarcerate somebody where they're not a taxpaying citizen, they're not contributing anything to the state's economy, it makes a lot more sense for that person to be out in the community, to have a job, to have secure housing. That's one of the goals of the Smart Justice campaign.
Excellent. Folks, we're about halfway, just a little past our halfway mark with our chat with Gus Marks Hamilton. He is a Smart Justice field organizer with the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU of Connecticut, just about to go into a press conference, which you undoubtedly have heard about up until when we broadcast this program on Sunday morning. So a part of what's going to be on the agenda today for the press conference, Gus, is legislative priorities and some ideas and advocacy. In the last few minutes that we have with you, can we run down a few of the key points, particularly maybe some of the ones that you feel have gotten some interest and some energy behind them in past sessions that maybe are poised to turn the corner and become a law or policy in 2019?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. There's two legislative priorities that we're particularly focused on for this session, and they kind of are at both ends of the criminal justice system. One is looking at transparency out of the state's attorney's office. In Connecticut, state's attorneys are not elected as they are in most other states around the country. They're appointed by the Criminal Justice Commission, but there's not a whole lot of information that comes out of the Division of Criminal Justice. So the first legislative priority we have is hoping to get some data. It's sort of a data collection bill. Everything when it comes to the demographics of people that are incarcerated, people are convicted of felonies and misdemeanors, trying to break down some of the plea deals that they receive, who receives bail, the sentences that they end up serving. The second bill is sort of a more broader bill looking at anti-discrimination for people who have been convicted of a crime, whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor in Connecticut, and trying to, people that have been convicted of a crime, people who are living with a criminal record, face hundreds of legal barriers in the state when it comes to access to affordable housing, when it comes to education, insurance and credit. I don't think a lot of people know about those. So the anti-discrimination bill would try to level the playing field so the people who are justice impacted or people who are living with a criminal record will be able to get their lives back on track.
Very good. What are some of the other ideas that the ACLU will be advocating to lawmakers to begin thinking about this year? Any other longer-term plans or perhaps even some initiatives that may have been introduced in the past and then sort of were deprioritized? Anything that you might be bringing back?
Well, I can talk to what the Smart Justice Campaign is trying to do. The Smart Justice Campaign, we're not just focused on this legislative session. We understand that the criminal justice system, I mean, there's been a lot of work. I mean, Connecticut has been doing a lot of work, reform work over the last 8 years, and we don't anticipate that everything can be solved in a single legislative session. We look at the Smart Justice Campaign as something that's going to be going on for a long time. So, I mean, the two bills, the anti-discrimination bill and the prosecutorial transparency bill, those are our focus for this legislative session. But we certainly anticipate that going forward over the next few years, there's a lot of work that we can do.
Very good. Is there some way that residents can engage in this initiative? Because ultimately, the fastest way to move lawmakers toward the water and make them drink is to be sure that they know that their constituents want them to deliver something.
Oh, I like that metaphor a lot. But yeah, our website, the Smart Justice Campaign, is a big part of the ACLU's website. That's ACLUCT.org. We have a petition on the website that people can sign. We have a lot of we have fact sheets about the campaign. We have a blog that we write that we talk about some of the work we've been doing over the last 6 months or so. People can follow us on all the social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I mean, yeah, we're all over the place. So we'd encourage people to get involved with the campaign we're working on. And, you know, like I said, our goal is to make Connecticut safer and stronger for everyone. That's just not people that are formerly incarcerated or people that are living with a criminal record. We believe everyone in the state of Connecticut is just as impacted, whether you're a taxpayer, whether you're a family member of someone who has a criminal record. We believe everyone in the state of Connecticut should be involved in this.
Well, when you consider that shocking per person number that you quoted a little bit earlier as how much it costs our taxpayers for every single individual who is incarcerated in the state,
even
when you consider that last year, Connecticut incarcerated the fewest people in almost a quarter century and reported the lowest crime rate. There are still a lot of cost points occupying rooms and beds in correctional facilities here in Connecticut and outside the state. So we wish you well with the Smart Justice Program, folks. We're talking with Gus Marks Hamilton. During the 2018 gubernatorial election, a statewide poll found the majority of Connecticut voters believed it was important to reduce the number of people imprisoned in the state, and large majorities supported specific legislative proposals to reduce incarceration. Connecticut's chapter of the ACLU is going to be working on that starting shortly after we hang up the phone with our guest this morning, and throughout the legislative session. We'll look forward to talking with you, Gus, and folks from the ACLU about further successes as the session develops. Thanks for being part of our program this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.